Hello out there, you wonderful whales. Thanks for joining us for another week of A Little Greener, a podcast all about nature, conservation, and sustainability. I am one of your hosts. My name is Sarah, and I'm joined this week by the wonderful Casey. How are you doing today, Casey?
Hello, I am tired, but I am here and happy to be recording with you. How are you?
I'm doing all right. A little off the regular schedule. We just had daylight savings time.
Ugh.
This past weekend, and I thought, Casey, that I was going to escape it because I got mixed up and I was thinking that we did it Sunday night, not Saturday into Sunday, but
all
of my clocks change automatically. So I just woke up on Sunday morning and didn't even realize that anything had happened because I was preparing to go to bed early that night. And so I was like, well, I didn't even, whatever, it's fine. But I definitely still, normally I don't sleep very well and I always wake up around 2 o'clock in the morning. And I definitely woke up last night at 3 o'clock in the morning, which is too close to the time that I normally have to get up. And so it messed up all of my sleep.
100% agree. You can't outrun this dang time. A construct, and yet we've decided to make it extremely complicated. So yes, I think that's catching up with me. The day of, I had gone to bed early, but I'm tired, guys. Yeah. I don't know about you all, so take care of yourselves out there. Sarah,
yes,
remind us of what our homework was.
Oh gosh, I feel like I said three random things related to herbicides. We talked about herbicides last time, and we talked mostly, I think, just about being aware of what you can do in your world to reduce your herbicide use and or to understand a little more the herbicide use in the agriculture sector in your area. So sort of vague challenges related to that. I did hand pull some weeds since we talked last. So there you go. I mean, again, you and I, that we kind of already have our personal plans in place. So, but I, like I was saying, I do actually have chemical herbicides just as a sort of just in case type thing, but I will try to exercise my self-control and not be lazy and get out there and pull. I did also choose to leave some, I have some yellow and white flowers growing next to my walkway. And I'm like, you know what? I like the way they look. They're just going to stay there.
Yeah, I think about clover, which a lot of traditional lawn folks are always trying to get rid of the bunch of clover in their yard. But then a lot of people who are trying to replace their lawns or implement some cover crops in areas are using clover.
That's an option. Yep.
It's a lot of perception and what your particular perspective is on what you're looking for is what qualifies as a weed or something that you do or do not want there. So just always interesting. I find that a little bit fascinating. Everybody's starting to get the itch for gardening because it was 65 degrees today.
Yeah. So woo-hoo.
I mean, it's going to bounce back down again, but it's going to be 70. It's crazy. So hopefully it's getting to be good weather in your guys' area and you're going to be able to spend some time outside, spending a little time in nature. Sarah, we are going to pivot into a little bit of the animal world again. It's been a while.
Yeah, I'm excited.
I'm excited too. My icebreaker question for you today is, do you eat shellfish?
No, at least not with any sort of regularity. Most of it I don't like. To me, shellfish, the first thing I think of is shrimp, probably because my father likes or used to like shrimp. But I just never... It just always seemed disgusting to me. And indeed, the first time I tried it, I was like, yep, my thoughts were correct. So I'm just not big on most of it. I don't know if I've ever tried crab or lobster or anything, but I've just never really had the desire to. I have eaten, are snails shellfish? Do they count? Are they in that category? Not sure, but I have.
I don't know. I'm Googling
once or twice had them and... Mussels would be the thing that I probably like the most. I think they're considered a shellfish too. But again, I enjoy them, but I've only had them maybe 3 or 4 times in my entire life. So it's not something I consume with any sort of regularity.
They are shellfish, by the way.
Excellent.
Snails. Yes. So marine animals in the shellfish category include crustaceans and mollusks. Examples are shrimp, crabs, lobster, squid, oysters, scallops, and snails. I wouldn't have thought of squid either.
I would not have thought of squid either. That's what I was
I
about to
know.
say.
I wonder from, this is from the Mayo Clinic, so I don't know if it's from like a biological
Yep.
perspective or just an allergy grouping
Yeah, I was going to
perspective.
say, I
Yeah.
wonder if there are different definitions depending on who you ask. And probably I would be, this is silly because I'm an animal science person, but I would probably be more specific or more familiar with it from the allergy side, actually, than the biology side because I'm not a marine person.
I know. Now I just Googled what is a snail. And the answer is a gastropod mollusk. All right. Well, more digging into that.
Yeah.
We're not talking about shellfish today at all. We are a little bit.
I know why you're asking it though. So if you don't yet, you'll find out.
Yeah, I basically we're going to be talking about the Atlantic right whale today, and I was prompted to think more about this particular topic because a news article came across my feed that was something along the lines of, should we stop eating lobster to save whales? Which is one of those like nice provocative headlines that I feel like is like just enough to pique your interest, but not enough to necessarily enrage you and misinform you. So I decided to do a little bit of look into what's going on with Atlantic right whales, North Atlantic white right whales, what their conservation issues are, and where they're at right now. So stick around and we'll get right to it. And we're back. Today we are going to be talking about an endangered species that's native here to the waters around the eastern United States. So, Sarah, this is an animal that if you were to travel, like, I don't know, within 150 miles of each of us, you would have the potential to run across, depending on the time of
Yeah,
year.
that's really cool. I didn't think about that until you started saying it. But yeah, that is fun. They're like a
Yeah.
bridge between us.
Yeah,
Aww. You should be
I
the podcast mascot.
Oh, yes, I'm so for it. The North Atlantic right whale is one of three right whale species, and I was just wondering if you know why they're called right whales.
I do, as of a few days ago, I
Oh,
came
really?
across this
Go
when
for it.
reading about them. And, or maybe we've talked about it before, but it certainly hit me when I was reading it like it was the first time because it's sort of terrible and it
Yes.
makes me not want to call them that. They are called right whale because they were the quote unquote right whale to hunt. Because was it something like because they float up
Yes.
when they're, yeah, horrible.
Yeah. I think sometimes when you're talking about whales, it's so important to think about how just world-changing the whaling industry once was. For the vast majority of the world, whaling's no longer a factor in basically anything that we do. Most countries have outlawed it. If you haven't listened to our Marine Mammal Protection Act episode, and I think I did one on whaling, was it both?
I feel like we talked about it a lot during that podcast and that we've maybe had it as a news topic to start the pod before, because I do feel like we've talked about it a couple times.
The Marine Mammal Protection Act one was a very early podcast episode that we did, but I remember really enjoying doing it. But most of the world, we probably don't think about whaling, but for a really significant couple centuries there, whaling was an incredibly important industry and genuinely changed the world, including how our oceans operate, basically, because the population of whales on planet Earth today is still lower than it was during prior to the whaling era. And just thinking about the fact that we call these whales right whales because of the whaling industry
Yeah.
not having anything to do with their biology, as it is for, like, their habitat or anything like that, it's just kind of wild to think about that, like, little impact that is still remnant. I was doing a little bit of research about what their populations used to be, and they've done some really interesting work of looking at the DNA of samples of historical whaling artifacts and trying to figure out, extrapolate what the population of these animals used to be. They used to be found all along the East Coast, so basically all the way down to Cape Canaveral, Sarah, and then all the way north up to Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And then they used to have actually pretty robust populations around Iceland, Greenland, and then over into the UK. Even the Mediterranean used to have a lot of right whales in it. Today, North Atlantic right whales are basically exclusively found along the east coast of the United States and up until Canada. They have found some rogue ones in the last 30 to 40 years hanging out on like the coast of Spain and places like that, but they found that those are migrants from the population that is on the east coast of the US. So super, super interesting for you and I. This is actually a pretty local species.
Yeah.
And they're mostly coastal whales. Sorry, go for it.
Well, I was just going to say, did you learn anything about historic number? Because we're down, we should say, like, this North Atlantic right whales, there are hundreds. Like, this is a population of hundreds, like 300 and something.
360.
Yeah. So that's the population that we're dealing with right now. Do we know anything about historical numbers at all?
Really difficult to extrapolate, yeah. But they estimate based on like the number of whales that they were bringing in on a yearly basis, that is somewhere between 9 and 21,000, I think is the numbers that I found. Obviously a really big range, but also compared to their current population size, exponentially larger than we're currently at.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Thanks for the clarification.
Just yeah. Thanks for curious. Following up on that factoid that I didn't close the circle to. While we're talking about this, as always, all of our sources are in our show notes. I did a lot of reading for this one, but I've mostly listed information from NOAA, which is the National Oceanic Atmosphere Association. We always mess it
up. Every time we need to write it down.
I'm
every
so
time
confident until I get halfway through. Government organization that looks over our oceans and our atmosphere. There's a great article from Vox, which is basically along the lines of, we know how to save right whales, so why aren't we doing it? And then there's some great information from the New England Aquarium, which has done some studies on it as well. There's a podcast episode that I've linked to that talks about the most recent updates in 2024 about these whale populations. So there's lots of great data out there. Highly recommend checking it out in the show notes if you are interested in the, going a little deeper with this topic. Maybe diving deeper like a whale. unlike some of the other whale species, especially large baleen whales, like a North Atlantic right whale, these whales spend most of their time on the continental coastal shelves. So this is actually a whale that you could potentially see from shore.
Yeah.
So,
which is so cool. And I so because cool. I just feel like when most people, or I shouldn't even say that, when I think about whales, even though I know that during some times of the year we have these whales on our coast here in Florida, but when I think about whales, I think about the other side of the country. I think about the other ocean. I think about Alaska. I think about going yeah. out on the boats and going to sea. But yeah, it's pretty cool that these big whales are close enough to the coast that you might even be able to see them. I was trying to compare in my mind. These guys were talking like half the size of a blue whale, like twice the size of an orca-ish, right?
Okay,
is
yes.
kind of what we're in. Like, they're about 50 feet long.
Yeah, so like 9 or 10 times as long as you are tall, most likely, if you're listening to this podcast. that gives you a little bit of a range there. So a really large whale, I do always think of the open ocean when I think of whales, so it is very cool that you could see these along the coastal lines. Their use of habitat is pretty flexible, so they do typically dive down to the ocean floor and feed throughout the water column. One of the things that they really help within the ecosystem is nutrient transfer, which is something I don't often think about when it comes to whales. But basically what they do is by diving down and consuming large amounts of animal matter, typically like microorganisms or you know, plankton, krill mm-hmm. sort of things down lower in the water column, they come up to breathe and they are surface poopers.
Fun fact.
So they transfer some of those nutrients up to the surface of the ocean where there's a lot more sunlight. And so it actually is part of the way that nutrients cycle through different areas of the ocean is using whales, which is crazy.
Wow. Man, everybody poops. And sometimes it's really valuable for the environment.
For real, for real. Also, when large whales die and they fall to the bottom of the ocean, that can be a huge source of nutrients for animals that live deep down. So that ends up being this huge feeding smorgasbord for the animals. So
huge.
Really interesting. Just like the massive size of this animal really does impact the oceans on this larger scale. They use their habitats flexibly depending on food resources and whether or not they're going to have a baby. So they typically are most likely to migrate south, and they, if they're a pregnant female, and they give birth between Cape Fear in North Carolina and Cape Canaveral in Florida. That's like their normal breeding ground. So if you live along the coast of South Carolina or Georgia, that's a really major part of where North Atlantic right whales will reproduce. But they spend a lot of their time, especially if they're not a breeding female, up in like the Massachusetts area and Cape Cod.
So they won't necessarily come down here if they're not having baby.
Right. Yes. And it really is food dependent. So they're more likely to like move farther out into the ocean if their food resources change. One of the things we're not going to talk a whole lot about in here, because it is an important factor, but not the main reasons that North Atlantic right whales are having a population issue. Climate change is a significant factor in ocean temperatures and food distribution for a lot of animals. And if those food distributions change over the course of time, that can absolutely impact populations. But that's not like the acute
right
what's going on. It's just an added challenge that they're going to have. So that's kind of a brief little window into what North Atlantic right whales are. There have been some signs of trouble for a while. So obviously, historically, the populations have dropped due to whaling. So somewhere from 9,000 to like 20,000, they dropped down into the hundreds already. And when the endangered species list was originally constructed, they were immediately put on the endangered species list because we knew that there was a small enough population that even if they weren't actively facing hurdles that were helping them decline, they had a small enough population that any sort of event could potentially cause some major issues when it comes to their genetics or their population die-off.
And it's a little distressing to me to read that and to see that they were placed immediately on the endangered species list, and we are still sitting here however many years later that is. I can't do math right now.
Sure.
But then we're still sitting at a population of 360 individuals.
Yes. What I will say, this is actually a pretty common criticism of the endangered species list, is that many, many animals do not come off of the endangered species list.
And I wasn't even intending it as that kind of criticism, just that it feels like such a low number after a long time. Obviously, these are longer lived animals, so we're dealing with that as a complication as well. They're not going to, you know, their population is not going to grow that quickly because of how their lifespan is. But I don't know. It just, 360 is not a big number.
It's not. It's actually higher than it was, I believe, in 1990. There was only like 260 or something terrible.
So that's good.
Yeah. So we are up. I guess I just bring that up because I do hear that sometimes. It's like, what is even the point of the endangered species list if we're not saving animals? I think the important thing to think about when it comes to the endangered species list is how many animals would be extinct if that list didn't exist.
No doubt.
Like, that's the endangered species list provides extra protection and funding for recovery. So it's like thinking of a population as in like terrible danger. It takes so much work and so much time to get it to recover. So
for sure. I totally. Totally get that. I mean, that's why you hear about these discussions about animals being taken off the endangered species list, and sometimes it'll be the conservationist saying like, no, like we, right. it's like, even if there have been successes and the population has grown, we're like, we are not ready to lose those protections that are provided. So yes, I don't mean to imply that it's not helpful or doing anything.
Yeah. Well, even with those protections, there's certain species that you think about, like, well, then they swim into a different country and then they don't have the protections there. But like, these are pretty protected animals and they largely live within the coastal waters of the US. So there's not a lot of like international interference in their populations. Like, that's not really what's going on there. So we had about, I think, 270 in 1990. The population started to increase. We were having lots of reproduction. But starting in 2017 or so, they were seeing what we call an unusual mortality event, which we will kind of dive into. We talked a little bit about it during our Marine Mammal Protection Act episode. The population started taking some pretty major hits. I think we've lost about 20% of the population since then, which is pretty huge in the course of the last 7 years or so. And it's not just population size. So right whales can live to be 70 years old. You mentioned that they're really long-lived animals, but the females are currently reaching about 45 years old and the males around 65. Typically, historically, the females would begin reproducing around age 10. That was about the average for the beginning of reproduction. And they were reproducing about every 3 years, so having about one calf every 3 years. But now we're seeing that interval extend to once every 6 to 10 years.
That is the opposite of what we would like to be seeing.
It's hard to rebound when you are only having one baby every that often.
Right.
Especially because there's only about 70 reproductively active females in the population. According to New England Aquarium, about 40 of the females between the ages of 10 and 20 have yet to given birth to a baby. Yeah. So there's like a decent chunk of the population that should be reproductively active that we are not seeing be reproductively active.
Yeah, none of those are good trends. And it's, you hear the population size, and that, if that's not enough to make you struggle, like 70.
Yeah.
Reproductively active individuals. I'm trying to think of a good analogy, but it's just like, I don't know, like I went to church on Sunday and we probably had 70 people sitting in the room, like, you know, as many people sitting in that room. That's it. Like, that's the entire population.
Spread out breeding over the course of this huge area, right? So I wonder sometimes when you have populations that are that small spread out over a large area, sometimes one of the issues that they come in contact with is that they have issues finding each other because they are spread out. I haven't seen that cited, but I wonder if that might be an issue, is because you have fewer and fewer potential reproductive partners that you have less opportunities for contact. But whales do have a lot of communication tools. They're very loud. They use sonar, might be the wrong word, but you know, you've heard whale calls. They do that. And that's how they contact each other. The bigger issue seems to be more of like the amount of energy it takes to have a baby. So getting back into what's going on, the UME is an unusual mortality event, and it's any event where we're seeing an unusual amount of die-off. It's pretty self-explanatory within the population. And it is legally an event, once it's designated, that needs to be investigated by the government. So under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, they have to start actually looking into it. I always thought it was more of a, like with sea lions, they were having one because of disease or toxic algae blooms. But that is not what's happening here. And I thought that was really fascinating.
Yeah, I feel like if we've had the same for, say, manatees down here, and it is interesting to me. I think of an event as a specific thing, but this has been going on now for seven years. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that is very interesting to use that term here.
Right. And I think it just mostly is a like legal term, but it is literally anything that's causing unusual amounts of mortality within the population can be considered UME. And for North Atlantic right whales, the two big things that are causing this die-off are entanglement in fishing gear and vessel strikes, so getting hit by boats. So let's break that down a little bit. I found some of these numbers kind of shocking. So there's chronic entanglement issues within this population. Because they live on the coast, they're really close to a lot of human activities, including fishing. And they are susceptible to getting entangled in fishing gear, specifically lobster lines, things for snow crabs, and then ground fish hook and line, which I am not a fishing expert, so I'm going to do my best on this. To give you an idea of the scale of what's going on, an estimated 83% of right whales have been entangled in fishing gear at least once. Around 59% have been entangled multiple times. And if a whale is spotted dragging fishing gear, there's a 25% chance they will die within a year. I just find that like so overwhelming as far as numbers go.
Absolutely. I'm just trying to think, 83% of the population, like what to even equate that to. But I mean, I guess once again, we're not dealing with an incredibly high population, but still, so once again, if we've got numbers this high, and we'll probably talk about this, the need to change the industry seems pretty striking to me if it's demonstrably affecting so much of the population.
Oh, absolutely. So they can tell entanglement either by reportings by the public saying, hey, we saw a whale dragging, you know, fishing gear, or by injuries spotted on the whale. NOAA tracks North Atlantic right whales using aerial surveys. So they will use aircraft to check them out. They use the patterns on their skin or the barnacles, the way that they grow on them, and any sort of identifying marker that a particular whale might have to be able to identify who they are. So like most of these whales have some sort of name or number, which is pretty incredible. There is in the show notes a list of all the moms and their calves from this season. So that's kind of cool because they track that super, super closely. So what happens is for like lobster lines, for example, lobsters live at the bottom of the ocean. They have a lobster trap. They drop it down. But in order to find the lobster trap, to be able to reel it back up to check if it's caught anything, and to make sure that other fishermen who are doing ground trawling, so that's a way that we try and catch shrimp. I don't know if that population overlaps in that area, but that is a technique, for example, to get things like shrimp off of the ocean floor. Those markers help them avoid those lobster traps as well.
Yeah. So if you're thinking about a lobster, well, you know, I thought lobsters were caught in these traps, and what could they possibly be and get entangled in? That's why. It's not just the trap sitting at the bottom. It's the line attached to the trap going up to the surface.
Right. It's like a vertical line. A author named Michael Moore from a book called We Are All Whalers described it this way. He said that hitting a line makes the whales panic and they tend to spin trying to evade it. But instead, they get multiple wraps of line around various body parts, such as the upper jaw, flippers, and tail. They cannot disentangle themselves. The wraps constrict through time and slowly squeeze the life out of the animal over a matter of months. So yeah, because I was also wondering a little bit of like, okay, if they just like hit it and keep swimming, because these are huge animals.
Right.
I thought that was very evocative because I don't always think about how animals emotionally react to something like that. Like a giant 50-foot whale hitting a rope.
Right. What's the big deal? But like imagine, I mean, what do we do if you're walking outside and you walk into a spider web? Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking. Most people, you're going to flail for a minute. You're going to flip. Just not even, like, I love spiders. I'm not just like, I don't mind having spiders
it's
around.
A surprise,
but
yeah.
You just, yeah, you're like, oh my gosh, like what is that? And you have a moment. And if your moment of panic get you more stuck, then I thought the rest of it was tough to listen to too. Just the wraps constrict through time and slowly squeeze the life out of the animal over a matter of months. Like imagine that. Imagine if, you know, the spider web was thicker and stronger, and instead of being able to peel it off, it just was stuck to you for the rest of your life.
And you didn't have fingers.
Yeah.
There's no way to like pull it.
Yeah.
Yeah, these whales, they'll sometimes get injuries of just like it's constricting, even if the line's eventually broken, they'll have injuries of it dug into their skin. But also if they're dragging that fishing gear, it creates like a physics issue of extra drag, which means it takes more and more energy to swim. And so it takes more and more food to be able to support their own subsistence. And so the energy loss due to entanglement can cause delays in calving and reduce their ability to produce milk, to travel down to the proper calving areas where they know that there's going to be more food. In the meantime, it takes a lot to get down there. When the right whales give birth, their babies are like 14 feet long. That's a big baby. Even if you're a 50-foot whale, that's a big baby. And they put on like a foot of length every month when they're first born. The moms are extremely attentive. Like, you shouldn't see a baby without its mom because she is right up there in there. And I can tell you as a human mom, this is very tiring already without anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so they think that this is actually the main driver probably behind why we're seeing delayed reproduction, why we're seeing longer intervals in between calving, is because it's just taking longer for these females to have enough energy to devote to successfully have a calf.
Yeah. And so all of this is pointing towards not being able to recover your population. And also, just a reminder, we said we weren't going to talk about it much, but you can see how something like climate change and changing ocean temperatures is a compounding factor in right. all of this, because that food source is becoming extra important and perhaps less available because of those things. So.
Yes, I read a round table basically that a bunch of different stakeholders did predicting potential outcomes for right whale populations, and some of the different scenarios that they went through is that at ocean temperatures warmed, certain cycles of the ocean either became stronger or weaker and influenced food sources. So if things go their way, it's going to slow the damage that these impacts have. But this is really the acute driver mm-hmm. of this population decline, which is just really such a bummer because we spent so long decimating their populations in the first place. And now we're accidentally right. doing it. Like, no one wants this to happen. There are things we can do about it, but no one wants to entangle whales. The second thing is vessel strikes. So, Sarah, I put a link there. I want you to click on it. And then, are you on that website?
I am on the website.
Cool. Scroll down a little bit till you see an animation.
Whoa, there's blue dots going everywhere.
Yes. Do you know what those blue dots are?
Wow. Okay. So, y'all, I'm looking at a map here of the East Coast. We're sort of off New York, New Jersey area. And I have got blue dots going everywhere that represent boats, vessels, and it is crazy. It is like the worst game of Frogger that you've ever seen. And then I've got one little red dot swimming its way up the coast, having to face this horde of swarming blue vessels going every which way.
Yeah, so there's lots of boats from like just fishing boats, but this area is the Port of New York. So this is a huge shipping lane
and
for
I think
international waters.
This, for somebody who is not familiar with shipping, has never really spent much time on the coast seeing this type of traffic. We don't think about this. I will count myself among them. I don't think about how much shipping traffic there really is.
Yeah, we get in a lot of supplies this way. I remember during mm-hmm. the pandemic, there were a lot of delays when it came to shipping. We got our bulbs, like tulips and things. They come from the Netherlands, who are famously like flower people. and there were delays through the Port of New York because just the vast amount of traffic and then not enough people to be able to process it and the lack of shipping containers, all sorts of things. Again, this is in the show notes. Highly recommend that you yeah. check it out. But you can really visualize just the speed of these boats going and the number of them. And this little whale, just like,
right,
he's swimming.
It's a minefield.
It's a minefield. And you can see him like pause. This is actual data. It's from a satellite-tagged one-year-old right whale that was tagged originally off the coast of Virginia, North Carolina in March 2021, and making his way up from basically Atlantic City up past New York City. Yeah, he's like having to pause. He's having to dodge. It's wild.
Yeah, it's a time span of about 3 days or so, 4 days maybe.
Yeah.
Trying to watch it all the way through. But yeah, definitely check out the link. It is eye-opening for me for sure to see. Because I do think it's another one you hear about, like, oh, getting hit by vessels. And you sort of feel like it's a big ocean out there.
So
they
much
should
ocean.
Be able to find their way around. This is, like I said, the worst game of Frogger you can imagine. That would be an incredible challenge for a whale out there.
So there's a couple things that we are doing. Like, these are on the endangered species list. They actually have a lot of federal funding, including, very recently, $82 million through the Inflation Reduction Act, which we talked about basically as the climate change bill a couple years ago. This was granted specifically for North Atlantic right whales to help develop technologies for vessels to be able to detect these whales before they actually hit them.
Yeah. I was really excited to see that just since we had talked about it, especially.
Yeah.
It was really cool to see this specific thing, like a specific grant that has come out of that act to work on protecting these animals.
Yeah, thinking about basically a couple industries that are really impacting the survival of right whales, but also making changes to those industries will present challenges for average consumers,
sure.
But also obviously like for lobsters, small fishermen who depend on this industry. The government of Maine, for example, was going to put in some construction or some restrictions on some processes in the lobster fishing industry. As many industry groups are pretty hostile towards any sort of changes that might impact the economic feasibility of their jobs. The lobster fishing industry is not super, they don't like to take a lot of responsibility for the entanglement factor of it. They really want like conclusive evidence and are a little bit defensive about being blamed for these whales' decline. It is interesting to think about like this whole industry potentially having to be changed for 360 individual whales.
Sure.
I think it should.
Yeah.
But it is interesting to think about it from their perspective. Is there's like,
yes.
Like ecologically speaking, seems like not very many whales to have to change everybody's livelihoods for. But there are solutions. But that is sort of a historical factor as well.
Yeah. I was reading something about, I don't know if it was the industry as a whole or a specific fishery that had to start using purple ropes.
Huh.
Do you know what I'm talking about? So that they would be able to identify if whales were getting tangled in their gear.
Oh, that makes so much sense. Yeah. Which looking, I just did a quick Google search, is Maine fishing rope found in dead North Atlantic right whale. And it said the gear had purple marks consistent with gear markings requirements for Maine lobstermen.
Yeah, that was just something I came across, and I didn't tag anything and put anything in the notes. But I thought that that was an interesting piece in terms of, as you were saying, accepting responsibility for things. That was something that I'd come across that had been implemented.
Yeah. Interestingly, this article here, and I will pop it into our show notes too, is just from February 14th, 2024. So very, very recent. And yeah, it is important to be able to be definitive on where we're tracking down what's causing this. That being said, is like how many whales have to die before we're allowed to make certain changes?
Right.
It's like, well, let's get a good sample size. Like there's not enough whales to manage a good sample size before we make any sort of change. So what can the lobster industry do? There is something called on-demand lobster gear. So again, that normal process, you drop the trap down to the bottom of the ocean, you secure a line that goes up to the top of the ocean, you have a buoy, some sort of marker that says, hey, this is where your trap is, you can go find it again, and other fishermen can find it too. On-demand lobster gear basically has a like new technology, more like a satellite tracker on it. Instead of having to place a rope, they can find it through this tracking device.
That makes so much sense.
Totally.
Right off the bat. Like, that's, and I guess that was my thought. Like, like we were saying, nobody wants these whales to get entangled. Nobody wants to destroy an industry either. Yeah. Like, I want people to have jobs and I want people to be able to eat seafood if we can do so sustainably. So it does just seem like there must be a better way. And that sounds great to me.
Yeah, it's not foolproof. Now, like, I think anyone in any sort of industry like this that's like fairly close knit and uses fairly traditional methods is going to be a little skeptical of any time you try and implement major changes in the way that they're doing things. And so this industry has been a little bit like, okay, like, this is not inexpensive tech. And sure, if something goes wrong with the technology under the ocean, sorry about you, you're out of luck. Like, there's not much that you could do as far as that goes. But the pros are so significant for these whales that obviously this is where the role of government does come in, where they're able to have a program like what they do, where they lend the technology out to fishermen to try it out, to be like, hey, no money down, you can use this technology, see if you actually like it and it works for you, so they can get over that initial hurdle without investing a whole bunch of money on something that's not super well tested from the individual's perspective. So I think that that's really great, but at scale it is going to be a pretty costly transfer over. That being said, the end consumer is the one who potentially would be impacted by the cost of lobster fishing, hunting. I don't know. Feels like it should be hunting. I don't feel it. I don't. Are you fishing for it? They're walking into a trap. I don't know. I'm sure it's fishing.
I go fishing.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, fishing. If it's more expensive to get your lobster from the ocean, then the end consumer has to be willing to pay more for the lobster. I don't know about you, and I'm not from New England, and I know that, like, my friend Ian's mom makes amazing lobster. I don't know how frequently they have it. I don't eat lobster nowadays because I'm not a huge fan of, like, the kind of the process behind it, but it's not cheap to begin with.
Right.
So if it's already a special occasion thing, would it be something that we'd be willing to potentially spend more money on to protect the whales?
I feel like I'm not a good sounding board for this question because I don't want it anyway. But
fair, yeah.
And I mean, it totally does depend. When I was on the Gulf Coast of Florida not too long ago, I had seafood several times, and there were certainly times where I was like, geez, like, this is an expensive fish. And you don't think too much or know that much about the whys.
Yes.
Behind why something might cost so much. But if I knew that my lobster was costing a percentage more because it was now being caught sustainably with line-free methods, heck yeah, I'm willing to pay. But I'm not everybody, you know?
Right.
So,
but we have dolphin-safe tuna. It feels reasonable that we could have something that was like whale-safe lobster, that we would have a way to communicate that I think people would respond to. People love their dolphin safe tuna. We do not like dead dolphins and we don't like dead whales.
Yeah.
So I feel like if you were able to come up with the marketing of, like, you know, great for the ocean, no harm to whales caused by implementing this new technology, of course, I'm sure there'd be like some third party verification and it would end up being expensive. But I think that the consumer would respond well to that.
Oh, I agree. Let's pitch it. Like,
yeah. Yeah. Let's get some come graphics up with a logo. Going. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
No, I do. I like it though. And I, of course, my like rose colored glasses view is that I wish companies would just be willing to make less, like, to have their, and I don't know anything about the shellfish industry. I don't know how much, you know, the top of the, I was going to say top of the line, but that sounds bad considering what we're talking about. But you know what the fishing companies make or what their profit margins are or anything like that. But I wish that people would be willing to take just a slight hit. Like, if this is going to be something that does take more expensive gear or maybe takes more manpower, you know, sometimes I wish that we would be willing to revert to something that needs a little more manual labor, which is going to cost a company more, obviously, if you have to pay more people. But I wish that we would be willing to revert back to some things like that if it can make less of an impact on the environment. I just don't feel like companies are willing to do that most of the time. But
I'll have to do more digging. The lobster kind of industry reps, the way they frame it is that, and I don't know, I'm not claiming that they're wrong or right, but they really framed it that a lot of these main fishermen are small fishermen. It's not like a mega corporation that's really controlling the lobster industry. It's a lot of individual fishermen whose families have done this for many years. Perhaps they sell to like a larger conglomerate and that's who distributes the lobster. But that's sort of how they're framing it, is that it's an undue burden on a population that's already like, and I think that that's fair. I just think that, again, this is, if that's, you know, the case, I'll have to do more digging on that. But I do think it is a situation where, yeah, maybe that's where some of the dollars for conservation go, is trying to make that happen. And maybe that's like a PR campaign of the whale safe lobster.
Yeah.
And helping assist with that gear and making that happen, so that when you have things like certified sustainable seafood, if people are willing to pay a little bit more for, they might be willing by the same token to pay more for lobsters. So that is the main and main the state, main the issue with whales. We're tired here. but of course there's also vessel strikes. So there have been some rules put in place to help protect whales. Specifically, they have limited the speed of vessels that are 65 feet and longer. They can't go more than 10 knots in certain areas where whales are normally found. And then there's additionally seasonal management areas based on where populations are at a given point in the year, of like voluntary speed limits for vessels that are smaller than that. Oh, you're making faces. Tell me more.
I just, voluntary speed limits. Like, I don't.
Yeah.
That doesn't seem particularly effective to me.
I agree. I mean, so the actual rule that limits the amount of speed of those larger vessels has seemed to reduce ship strikes by 82% in those seasonal management areas. Also, we have an increase more recently. It might be due to the population using the habitat differently than they have historically, because remember, they're flexible in how they use that habitat. Mm-hmm. So if those seasonal management areas aren't responding quick enough to where the whale distribution changes, then we're still going to have a lot of vessel strikes. There's also a current rule for the boats 65 feet and longer, but there is evidence that smaller boats also lead to injuries that can be devastating for young animals. So there's a calf of a female named Juno from this year who has severe injuries, including, they think, like a broken jaw and head injuries from a vessel strike. And there's some evidence that vessels as small as like 30 to 45 feet are also causing some pretty severe damage to these smaller individuals. So I believe that they're in the process of pursuing more stringent rules for a smaller boat class. So expanding who is regulated by that speed limit that's not voluntary.
Sounds but they're great. Yes. Once again, good idea.
Good idea. Slow your roll. but as with many things in the government, there's so many little parts of the rulemaking process where you have to respond for comments, you have to revise, you have to make certain public things. Something along that process went hinky. I don't know if they did something wrong or if there was like a review that needed in place, but that has been on pause and they're working on trying to get that rule implemented. Again, this kind of boils down to the consumer. This is really what that Vox article is talking about, is like, we know how to save them, so why aren't we? And their sort of conclusion is consumers have to be aware of how they're impacting the whales, and they have to be willing to pay more, or in cases of these insane shipping lanes, be able to wait slightly longer for certain products. Like, are we willing, noting that those products are coming from overseas and have to get here via boat, which I often don't think about ever in my life. Literally, I only think about it when it's too slow. Like when our bulbs got stuck at port and they're like, sorry, they've already shipped. They're just stuck in New York. That's the only time I think about the shipping containers on the ocean.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because those two things, like being aware of it and being comfortable waiting longer, one of those I feel like we should be really good at doing. The other one we're bad at, obviously, in today's culture and society, we are not good at waiting for things. We do, you know, you've got your Amazon Prime and whatever else, we want things to get to us now, like order it this morning, it should be here, you know, this evening type of thing. So we're not good at that. That's tough. But man, getting it, awareness feels like it should be easier because we have so much ability to share information these days. And yet I don't feel like this is talked about ever. Like, I didn't know. I knew that the North Atlantic right whale was a very endangered species. I didn't realize that lobster fishing was their most imminent threat right now. So that that's feels like that should be something that would be easier to put out there. But I guess maybe there's just so much information in today's day and age that this, it just, you know, people have to pick and choose what they care about. And this just hasn't made it on enough people's radars in the way that dolphin safe tuna did finally. So,
yeah, well, I think a couple things about that is like, one, when a whale washes up on shore, it is actually a pretty big news story. Sure. Like, that's how it got into my newsfeed in the first place, is that like a young whale had washed up on shore. I think I find those extremely tragic and also a little almost debilitating. Like, I don't feel empowered after reading them, because typically what happens is that they'll wash up, they'll say they had some signs, but a necropsy has to be done and then it's not conclusive. And then it falls out of the news cycle before we get a real like answer.
We see the trauma, we don't hear about the actual deeper underlying cause.
Right, exactly. It's just like almost a shock journal. It's not intentionally a shock journalism, it's just the nature of how the investigation works, but like, it's a shock, it's sad, and then it's kind of gone before we really have any sort of information that might empower us to make different decisions. I feel like with dolphin safe tuna, like, that was happening in a way that was more intentional. Like, it was a lot easier to sort of visualize in that case, fishermen specifically either following or attracting dolphins to areas and then scooping up, well knowing that there were dolphins in there. And like, it felt to me more personal and malicious in a way. Again, like, course of business for some people, but like, that feels so immediate versus this passive, like, a whale happened to swim by and hit my lobster line, which doesn't help me either. But there's like a certain, after a while, negligence to it, not as a maybe an individual fisherman, but as an industry as a whole, if you know that this is happening at a large scale and like chronic, not just like, oh, a whale every once in a while. Like, most whales have been entangled multiple times. We know that this keeps happening over and over and over again. It's not one whale that had some poor navigational skills. So, yeah, I think we need to launch that, Sarah. Whale safe lobster.
We'll work on it.
There we go. Maybe we're just repeating an idea that exists. Yeah. So maybe that'll be your and my homework. It's still like a little bit more into it's like an actual thing, or if we invented something. I'm sure we haven't. I'm sure other people have come up with this, but I don't know if it's like an actual like certification or anything
right.
that people are exploring, like looking yeah. and happening. But yeah, I think the hopeful note is that we do like, it's not like we have to all give up lobster in order to save whales. There's technology that can let us have both. We just have to be willing to pay maybe a little bit more. And the fact that the Inflation Reduction Act has like, this is a significant amount of money. They've talked about this as game changing and like maybe the only thing that would accelerate the technology to the point where it could make a difference. This $82 million going towards right whale detection technology within shipping vessels. That's a huge deal. That's yeah. something that like, you know, not everyone agrees of where our tax dollars should go, but this is one that I can smile about. Mm-hmm. It's like, this is good. This is something that could make a difference to an animal that might otherwise go extinct. And still might. We've had, I think, 17 births this year, and the breeding season goes through March, which is it was between 14 and 17. It's a pretty robust year as yeah. far as it goes. There have been years that there have been zero calves born. So this is a pretty good year so far, and it seems like things are going, knock on wood, pretty well for this year, but it will take multiple of these years in a row, plus some, to build a population, not just start losing everybody through attrition.
Right.
So there's reason for hope, and I want to kind of get us on that note.
Yes, I like that. It's always good to close out with a little bit of hope.
Yeah. So we'll be back in just a moment with your challenge of the week. All right, guys, and we're back with the challenge of the week. I will tell you, on the brief little moment between our main body and this, I googled whale safe fishing gear, and there's so much more to explore. So please don't take this as an end-all be-all of like what's going on with right whales or whale conservation in general when it comes to the fishing industry. There is so much more to explore there. There's certainly so much more information out there. So if this sort of spiked your interest a little bit, I really hope that you'll just take this as a jumping off point, because you don't want like a sleepy new mom to be your end all be all of your research.
Well, look, there's only so much we can talk about in an hour long podcast.
It's true.
So
it's true.
This, you know, a jumping off point is fantastic. And we can always have more episodes on this in the future if we so choose.
We so choose. Or you guys want to hear more. Like, yeah. Let us know what you're interested in as far as that goes. So there's so much more out there. I think that's going to be my homework for myself, is to delve a little bit more into like what those solutions look like and what me as a consumer can look at to find like things like Seafood Watch is a sustainable mm-hmm. seafood website. So if you are someone who does consume seafood, whether it's shellfish or other things, take a look at seafoodwatch.org, because they have an updated list of different types of seafood, where it might come from, and all the conservation statuses that different methods of catching different populations might have. So I'm going to be exploring that a little bit, and hopefully next week I will, or next time, 2 weeks from now, I will have more a little update to give you on what I found on that. So do a little research if you're someone who's out on the East Coast or anywhere where whales are. Make sure that you're always practicing good, safe whale watching. You want to give them lots of distance. If you're operating a boat in that area, you're going nice and slow, so you're not part of that problem. And next time you go to the beach, summer's coming up, just take a look on that shoreline, because if you're on the East Coast, you could see a whale, and that would be so cool.
Yeah. And I'm sure that there are folks here in Florida and Georgia that don't know that we can see whales off of our coast during certain times of the year. I'm adding to my challenge list to go see if I can spot a whale. We're probably coming that to the end of the season for me this yeah. year, but maybe next January, February, I'm going to just go hang out at the coast for a while and do some whale watching.
Yeah, I'm definitely going to research too, like where along the coast near me you're most likely to see a whale, because I think that would be super, super cool. So yeah, so much more out there. Do a little research. Think about it when you're going out on the coast about how you might interact with or see a whale. I just think one of those true gifts in life to see an animal that large, because there's just not that many of them in this population or anywhere. So that's, I think, a super exciting thing. And so I hope that you'll take this as a jumping off point to think about that and maybe think a little bit more about what you'd be willing to pay more for in your life or slow down in your life if it meant that more animals were protected. That's my challenge for the week, Sarah.
Appreciate you, as always, Casey. Thanks for the discussion and bringing some new things to our attention.
Yeah, I love whales. That's what I've decided. I didn't know that already. Sarah, if they want to tell us their whale stories or let us
send
know
us whale pictures, please. If you've seen a whale before, if you've gotten to go whale watching, I want to see them.
I saw a whale from a helicopter once. It was so cool.
What a time to put that in there.
I know. I forgot about it till right now. It was not a right whale.
If you have whale photographs that you want to send us, you can find us on Facebook right now, A Little Greener Podcast. We are not back up and running on Instagram yet, so don't message us there. But you can also send us an email at alittlegreenerpodcast@gmail.com. You can send us questions, comments, future episode topic suggestions. Let us know what you want to hear about, all of that at that email address, and we're always happy to hear from you.
We appreciate you guys for listening. We hope that you have a safe couple weeks, and we'll talk to you soon.
Bye.